these meetings. This particular tradition of Buddhism is called Theravada, or sometimes Pali Buddhism, Pali being a scriptural language. And I hope to, because I'm here pretty constantly now, I hope to do some study on alternate weeks, but we can talk about that later. And the Pali canon is the scriptural basis of this particular school of Buddhism. And it's the school of Buddhism that's practiced in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Laos. Right? So I was trained in Thailand. There is a lot of emphasis on the texts in this particular school, which sometimes makes it seem very intellectual. And if you leave the spiritual life up in the head, then that's the spiritual life. So you have to learn how to integrate the intellect with the heart. So some people find the scriptures appealing. Many people can't figure them out, which is all right. And so I was very fortunate to have very good teachers. I enjoy reading some of the texts, but I'm glad I had good teachers, because there's something about human experience and the sharing of human experience which is unique, really. So I'd just like to read a bit and then talk around this kind of way that these texts talk about. So these would be the, historians consider these to be the oldest texts that exist in Buddhism. So we would say it's the word of the Buddha. I can't prove it, but that's what historians think is the kind of closest we have to the way the Buddha was taught. Now the texts themselves became standardized for memory, because the texts were not written down until about a good 500 years after the Buddha's death. Okay, so there was an oral tradition, just as there's an oral tradition in passing on genealogies, and that was trusted more than writing. And so the monastic communities would learn different bodies of these texts, and different communities within a monastery would be assigned different pieces to memorize, different discourses, different suttas. And so this whole body of work was carried through and then finally written down in Sri Lanka. So the style can be very repetitive, can be very stilted, can be hard to get into, because it was meant for chanting. So the way the early monastics functioned was to memorize a text, memorize one of the teachings. And once you have these things in memory, they just pop up like anything else. If you read about something, we've all heard about Iraq, so Iraq pops up, doesn't it? So if you study something, and you study it and study it, you don't just kind of have a cursory reading of it. You just kind of read it through, oh, that's interesting, what's in the papers. That won't stick in your mind. So the way the old monastic communities worked was they memorized these things. And actually sat down and memorized it, which takes a bit of work. I think they had better memories, because they didn't have memory retrieval systems. They didn't have computers and the written words. So they had a faculty for memorizing. And I found that in Thailand that I had to memorize a lot of chanting, and that faculty improved. And then what happens in that learning of something and reciting of it, then it tends to come up into consciousness as an object of contemplation. And this is how study works in a contemplative situation. It's not the same as comparative religion or just accumulating information. That's not the nature of contemplative study. It's to stimulate our intelligence to observe life in a particular way. Thank you. To observe life in a particular way. And that's the way of Dhamma. Huh? This is the point of it. And whether you get that from an oral teaching or you get it from a written teaching, this is the point of teaching. It's not to accumulate information. It's not to have opinions. You know, it's not to say that Theravada is better or worse than Mahayana, or that Theravada is not quite as loving as Sufism, or you know, whatever comparisons you want to make. But it's to get our consciousness thinking in terms of Dhamma, remembering Dhamma, we say, is very important, because so much of our information that we take on board is very worldly. Stock markets and political crises and so on and so forth. Different things that we might have in our heads. And that's the point of study. And hopefully that's the point of this kind of a meeting, where we are reminded of the Dhamma. And oftentimes you've heard it before, and it's just kind of remembering. One of the big problems is that we forget. So remembering. Right, so let me have a drink of water. This is from the Anguttara. Now, in these study sessions, what I hope to do is just give a brief outline of what the texts are. People kind of get confused with it all. And that'll give those who are interested an entry into it. But this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, a particular collection, the numerical discourses of the Buddha. No other thing do I know, O monks, that is so intractable as an undeveloped mind. An undeveloped mind is truly intractable. No other thing do I know, O monks, that is so tractable as a developed mind. A developed mind is truly tractable. No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much suffering as an undeveloped and uncultivated mind. An undeveloped and uncultivated mind truly brings suffering. No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much happiness as a developed and cultivated mind. A developed and cultivated mind truly brings happiness. No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much harm as a mind that is untamed, unguarded, unprotected, and uncontrolled. Such a mind truly brings much harm. No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much benefit as a mind that is tamed, guarded, protected, and controlled. Such a mind truly brings great benefit. No other thing do I know, O monks, that changes so quickly as the mind. It is not easy to give a simile for how quickly the mind changes. This mind, O monks, is luminous, but is defiled by adventitious defilements. The uninstructed worldling does not understand this as it really is. Therefore, for him there is no mental development. This mind, O monks, is luminous, and it is free from adventitious defilements. The uninstructed noble disciple understands this as it really is. Therefore, for him, there is mental development. So, you read something like that, and hopefully that stimulates you to mental development. And now, mental development in Buddha, in this context, is not just thought. When we talk about developing the mind, the word we have in the Pali language is citta, which is nowadays translated as heart-mind. And it refers to all of that inner process that we experience, the intentions, the moods, the perceptions, the conceptions, the historical biases that we have, the accumulated insights we have, the accumulated ignorance we have, all of that, that whole thing we call mind. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it, if one hasn't really developed one's inner world, if one has not paid attention to it, if one hasn't been diligent in that way, then one, you know, one just becomes a victim to that, don't you? One becomes a victim to one's moods, and one becomes a victim to circumstance, and there's no freedom. And the more we see that, without blaming ourselves, you know, without kind of laying a heavy trip on ourselves, but the more we see that, the more we are, I think, kind of compelled to really take responsibility and understand the mind and train the mind, develop the mind. And that's what we call the training. And I think I mentioned this last time. When a monastic takes up this lifestyle, be it a monk or a nun, the way we describe that is they pick up the training. We're not priests. We don't kind of... we don't have any rights, as it were, to sort of, you know, give you the magic wand so you get in quicker. We pick up a certain training. It's like, you know, you want to take Thai boxing, you go to a Thai boxing teacher. you know, a type of boxing, and, you know, teaches you how to kick people in the head and do other nasty things to people. Then you take up Thai boxing, right? And you have a trainer. And the trainer tells you, you know, this is the way you should do it, but you have to train. So in the same kind of way, a monastic picks up the training. That's the idea of it. And most of us really like this word training, because if one is just kind of looking for an experience, some kind of religious experience, it's terribly frustrating. You know, well, one reads about these great masters, and one tries to get that Sufi loving exalted experience, or the enlightenment experience, or the mystical god, or whatever it is, it can be terribly frustrating. But if it's training, that's what I find at least, if it's training, even though my mind might be in some negative mindset, or even though I might have really kind of strong habits which bring me suffering, which bring me confusion, bring my people around me confusion, even though that might exist in a sort of negative way, if I see, well, I can train with this, I can work with this, then that gives me hope. And it gives me kind of project, like I like to call this a Buddhist project. And it kind of makes sense of life. You know, the negativities that I experience and the confusions or whatever that come up in consciousness and so on, they're no longer just sort of inflicted by some law of karma that I have to endure until the sun shines. And that's an awful way to live, I think. You're just kind of waiting for happiness to be plunked down on you. The sun is shining, we can go skating, fine, I'm happy. Great, go for it. But happiness which is just sort of dependent on circumstances is flimsy stuff. When it's there, certainly enjoy it. So I was out today Lac Philippe, I think. And oh, this is so beautiful. This is so exquisite. What a lovely town this is, to have that park there during the summer, early in the winter. And so then I saw these two skidoos. Right. First thing, what are these guys doing here? There's pollution and noise. And Chris tells me they're grooming the paths for you. Oh. I see. But when we train, I'll get back to that example. When we train, the first thing we need to do is set up the inner witness or awareness. We need to develop a kind of second level of consciousness where we're really aware more and more profoundly of why we do what we do, why we act, why we think, the moods we have, the intentions that we follow, so that we can see the results of our lives. So this we call the inner witness. Ajahn Mun used the word called Suti Bhutto, with S-I-T-I, Bhutto, which is a kind of radiant inner witness, radiant knowing. So I'm at Lac Philippe parking lot, and these beastly skidoos coming along, and my first thought is, why don't they make laws about these people? Spoiling my fun. I'm a purist. Now that the inner witness then can see, this is the way things are. There is this lovely situation and there's this noise. And the inner witness, if the inner witness is honest, and what am I creating around that? And this is obviously terribly important, that I take responsibility for what I'm creating in this world. Because if I don't, then I'm the victim of endless skidoos. And then I'm kind of shuffling around on those little boards that you use and thinking about the skidoo. I don't know if it's the sun or the whatever. My mind's locked into some kind of negative mind state. So the inner witness, and then taking responsibility for the inner world. So this is the way we say, this is the way it is now, right? And then what is being created on that? What am I putting on top of that? What kind of thoughts are there? Are those thoughts skillful or unskillful? And what is the mood that's propelling them? What is the mood that's conditioning them? And that all sounds very simple, doesn't it? It's inner witness. Yeah, and this is the way it feels now. Yeah, that's the world, and this is my scenario. But I think if you try this, it's quite difficult. First of all, just to be in the present moment and not to be off the la-la land in the future or the past. That's very difficult, I find. And I think most people find that. So that's part of the training, is to get this inner witness going all the time. Now, the inner witness is not the inner judge. Right? And it's not the inner analyst. It's not that. You can analyze, you can judge, that's fine. But that's something extra on top, because the inner witness can know the judge. If I'm judging, I'm saying, oh, fair dumbo, you should be compassionate to the skidoo drivers. I can know that. I can witness to that. Oh, that's whatever. Or if I feel guilty for that, or whatever it is. So the inner witness is the kind of the furthest back you can get into the mind. You can't get any further than that. Huh? And that's very mysterious what that inner witness is. Awareness, knowing, pure presence. There's many ways that religion talks about it. And to train in making that sense of presence more and more and more constant is something that does not require a particular type of experience. This is lovely. You don't need sun, and the canal doesn't have to be frozen. And you can do that. You can keep training in that. So it's like there's something you can do. You know, even though. You know, life is up or down or whatever it is, you can train. Well, how is it now? How is it now? How is it now? How do we feel now? What's going on now? Not as an inner obsession. That's not it either. Or kind of some kind of narcissistic thing about yourself. It's just seeing the totality of one's experience. Not just the scenario or the storyline or the narrative, but seeing the whole thing, the mind. Because that's a part of it. So if I'm there and I'm just kind of not aware of my mind, then I'm just this kind of Pavlovian kind of chap reacting to life but not taking responsibility. Now the way the mind works and the way intention works is the more you make intentions towards wholesomeness, the more the mind realizes wholesomeness. And the more one makes intentions towards unskillfulness, the more unskillfulness dominates. So let's say I'm at the monastery and I'm very critical of all the monks. The more I don't awaken to that, the less I'm aware of this constant kind of judgmental, critical attitude to the monastic community, the more that dominates my mind. The more that critical faculty dominates my mind. And the more unhappy I become. But the more I can awaken to that, I can say, well, this is the critical mind. Or this is the judging mind. And the more I can make that suggestion to myself, the more I awaken to the critical mind. And the more I awaken to the critical mind, I can see the difference between, say, maybe discernment and aversion. There is a difference. Discernment is fine, but aversion is not good. It doesn't make me happy. It doesn't bring me to the luminous mind. And the more I make that suggestion to myself, and the more I watch, what I also notice is this also registers in the body. That not only do I feel aversion as a thought and a judgment, there's pressure in the head from aversion. And there's pressure in the heart. The heart's not open. And the breathing is also stuck. So I'm close because of aversion. Right? And the more I make that suggestion, well, how does that feel in the body? I've taken a huge step from just being caught in my habitual patterns and making a big step of saying, ah, this is a pattern. This is a mood. And I've gotten deeper than thought. And that's part of the training, is to try to get deeper than thought. Because thought, wrong thinking, say, we have right thought and wrong thought. Wrong thinking, which is just driven by moods and emotions, doesn't get you anywhere. And it just tends to perpetuate the melodrama. So classically what happens is, you know, you start to feel averse, and then you say, I shouldn't be averse. And you just get in arguments. That doesn't get you anywhere. But to actually know aversion as a mood, as a bodily feeling, as a whole tone of being, means you have to study. One has to be willing to study these things. Inner awareness is also inner inquiry. And this study, again, is not self-obsessed. It is self-knowing. Because a lot of these things, the theory is dead simple, dead easy. But the complexity of our hearts and the perversity of our moods is embarrassing. It's just, they just kind of come at you. you know, whether you know you get jealousy or whatever it is. So there has to be a willingness to allow this to come up, and that's one of the big problems in the spiritual life. Is as I often talk about, is the attachment to idealism and the aversion to the reality. The aversion to the reality of the negative states of mind that might come up. There are, in Buddhism, we talk about, one way we talk about attainments. So the attainment of various states of meditative absorption, you know, meditative stillness, the attainment of various states of contemplative insight, arahat, psychic powers. So there's this whole kind of teaching on getting something, right? And then there's also a whole body of language, whole body of teaching, which talks about letting go. Talks about letting go of anger, purifying the heart from greed, delusion, jealousy, and so on and so forth. Now, they're not mutually exclusive, because the more one lets go of egotistic tendencies, does let's go of them skillfully, the more the heart realizes its own luminosity. The more I take responsibility for annoyance and criticism and aversion, and I don't indulge it, I don't get caught up in thought, the more I feel it in the body, what happens is the body relaxes. And in the letting go of those kinds of self-limitations, the heart begins to kind of really open up. You get a sense of ease of being and begin to realize some of those kinds of attainments they talk about. But if one tries to get those attainments through greed, you get really frustrated. You know that you say, oh, if I could just get that. And then what happens, if I just try to get that, I deny this. And if I deny this, that's repression, isn't it? It doesn't work. So I have to accept this. So we say the beginning of true practice is acceptance. Which isn't complacency, which isn't condoning, but it's really, 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 really opening to what you're feeling. So acceptance. Acceptance does not have to be verbal. It's visceral. You know, if there's a kind of negativity going on in the heart, and one's really interested in it, this is the curious thing, and one has to be interested in one's own foolishness. One's own, you know, all the stuff that we go through. You have to be interested in it. Not in some, you know, just be curious about it. How does it work? Many of us, I find this, is that I don't want it. I don't want to feel the jealousy or the anger. I just want to be nice. And sometimes I am nice. You know? It does pop up. But sometimes it's not. And yet, I find one of the really wonderful sources of happiness is seeing a negative habit, identifying, I know you, you've been with me for 55 years, and not buying into it. And not dismissing and not denying, but really just knowing it and feeling it, riding it through, not dumping it on anyone, and seeing it cease, and seeing this kind of happiness from that being kind of liberated from the heart. It's an interesting kind of happiness. Because one has been willing to sort of let this kind of go through you. And it's not what one kind of, you know, sort of, the difficulty is acceptance. Because we, quite often, when these negative things come up, we either believe in them and pursue them with thought, or we deny them and try to distract them and get rid of them. So, witnessing, taking responsibility and accepting. And accepting is a very welcoming kind of practice. And this is why so much of Buddhist practice is, they say, like in Tibetan Buddhism, that compassion is the method. It's the method. It's what you know, it's not the end. It's the method. It's what you use. Because how can you understand yourself if you don't have compassion? How can I understand my own jealousies and limit, you know, these kinds of things if I don't welcome it or accept it into the heart? Now, if I haven't done that, let's say I think about myself, things like fears and anxieties. I never accepted them when I was younger. I distracted them. created an ego, personality, plus. But what happened, of course, is when I started to look at those things and be with them, the habit was to run away from them. The habit was to distract them. The habit was to blame. The habit was to read a book. So I'd start to feel negative or whatever, read a book about Buddhism, that'll help. You know, read the suttas, yep, that'll get me there. Well, I'd get distracted for a while, and then I'd put the book down, and the boo, and it comes again. It comes again. So there is this, almost like in the beginning of practice, and many of you have been practicing for quite a while, but it's almost counterintuitive, the practice of acceptance. It seems like if I accept this negativity into the consciousness, then it's just going to get bigger. Better fight it, better get rid of it, and knock it down. But that doesn't work, because that's still not understanding how the mind works. And if I put into the mind any kind of willful aversion and coercion and that kind of energy, then that's what's going to condition the next moment. It's not going to be love or peace. Means are the ends, aren't they, in Buddhism? So what are the means that I'm using? Are the means I'm using to understand myself just coercive or willful? That won't give you a peaceful result. But if the means are in themselves peaceful, so let's say I feel I'm with my mom and I feel annoyed or something like that, if I really just accept that annoyance, then that acceptance is the next sea of consciousness, not the aversion. The aversion is old karma. Right? It's just the program that I have to sort of understand and train in. So the aversion comes up because of causes and conditions. But then what am I doing right there? Am I then putting more aversion, like, oh, we shouldn't be like that? Or am I just dismissing it? Or am I blaming someone? What's actually happening in that moment? And that's the kind of acuity one needs in awareness. You really have to be very, very attentive. And if I see that this just feels, this is just aversion. Aversion just feels this way. To come to that kind of conclusion, then that's the seed of peace, isn't it? You cannot get acceptance with non-acceptance. It doesn't make sense, does it? So acceptance begets acceptance. Now that's uncomfortable, maybe. But the spiritual life is not comfortable. You know, you have to be willing to feel discomfort. You have to be willing to feel the heart in these various kinds of modes. So the way we talk about the practice of awareness is to try to take out what we call the personality view. It's not me being in a grumpy mood, it's just grumpy. That's all. Grumpiness feels this way. It's not me feeling restless, it's just restlessness. We're trying to extract from it this whole sense of me and mine and trying to see it objectively. So in the practice of witnessing and taking responsibility, right, we have all kinds of teachings and language around objectivity. Right, to begin to see that the mood of the mind, when you really look at a mood, it's an object just like this microphone. It's an object of consciousness. Now that the mood seems much, much closer. It's mine. And this is Phillips or the associations or whoever. But actually, when you don't proliferate on it with self-view, with self-thought, with I-thought, with ego-thought, with personality view, we say, you don't do that with a psychological self. There's kind of different languages we use for that. When you just witness to it, you begin to see it as just an object moving through consciousness because of causes and conditions. It's not a problem. And there's a wonderful freedom from that. There's a wonderful freedom because one is no longer feeling guilty about being human or getting lost and, you know, getting lost in these kinds of things. And as one does that, one begins to take that witnessing becomes stronger and stronger, and you see that's in that witnessing is where the luminous mind lies. The heart of the religious experience. But if I've not done that, then what will come up is the tendency towards craving. I want to get rid of this. I want to get something else. And there's the struggle. So in Buddhism, what we're always looking at, what is really the struggle right now with consciousness? Now, that's assuming that we're not just distracted. If we're distracted, well, there's no practice, right? And we have to try to find enough social situations where we can just collect ourselves. So that's a big problem that one has in modern society. People seem to be so busy and with family life and work and so on, get very stressed out. And so that's difficult. And I have no answers to that, except if you want to come to New Zealand and shave your head. But so what? This is why this kind of a meeting or a sitting is very important, where you can have a time where you can really recollect, where you can stop, and you can consider the heart, because that has a profound effect. It has a very, very good effect. So in terms of the Buddhist reflection on the way things are, what we try to, in right thought, in right analysis, what we try to say, well, what's the conflict now, if I'm having a conflict, right? What's the conflict? And we always just try to, around this present moment, what is it that I want, or what is it that I don't want? I always say this, don't I? What is it I have that I don't want, or what is it I don't have that I do want? Now that's different than judging the problem in the present moment as a particular type of experience. In other words, there's a difference between me thinking that anger is the problem, my anger is not a problem, it's just anger, and me either indulging in the anger or trying to get rid of the anger. That's the problem, the conflict with it. Anger arises because of causes and conditions. If I pursue it with wrong thinking, that'll make me more miserable. So I have to come to some sense of self-responsibility around that. Fear arises because of causes and conditions. If I just run away from the fear, that will be just more fear in my life. Greed arises for causes and conditions. If I just pursue the greed, that'll come up. So at some point in my spiritual life, I decide, well, I'm going to try to find freedom here now. Right here now. Right here now. Where's the problem? Where's freedom? Rather than putting off to the future when I'll never feel angry, or blaming someone else and thinking, well, if you were different, I'd be happy, or if we didn't have El Nino, I'd be happy, or you know, all the stuff that we do. No, right now, I'm going to take responsibility and say, right now is where I'm going to find freedom. And that's the whole sense of the spiritual life is this present moment responsible awareness. So what's the problem now? What is it that I want that I don't have? And if you take it deeper than thought, like let's say I'm feeling annoyed at the skidoos, right? I'm a walker. I don't like my past groomed. So I'm feeling annoyed at the skidoos. So that's a version in the mind. The narrative and following that would be the kind of lowest level of awareness. You just kind of keep thinking, right? Oh, those idiots, and what kind of government is this? That's called non-practice. And that, I mean, then you're just, that's it. That's your limit. Every time the skidoo comes, you're going to be averse. So there's no freedom. So at some point one says, well, I'm going to be living there, so these guys actually live next door, so if I'm going to live here for another 20 years, I better get this together. So, responsibility. Say, well, okay, what's the problem? The problem is they've got this. No, the problem is I'm averse to the skidoos. Now, if I've been averse to the skidoos for 10 years, I've taken a fixed position. This is what we do. Then if for 10 years, I've reinforced aversion to skidoos. Right? I've created a reality that all skidoo drivers are rednecks and whatever. Whatever one does with these things. People do that with winter. I hate winter. If you're living in Ottawa, that's not a good stance to take. It's not a good position. There's a difference between thinking of feeling unpleasant because of the weather. That's natural. But then to take that further, I hate winter. And to do that day in and day out, day in and day out, what's that condition the mind to? Intractability. The mind becomes intractable. And then in July, one thinks, oh, the winter's close. And then the first no. And that's what we do with the mind when we don't protect it, when we don't guard it, when we don't train it. So let's say that I have unfortunately taken a position on hating the winter. But one day I decide, well, I'll probably live here for a while and I want to be happy. So when winter starts to come and I feel that aversion, the training of the mind is to say, oh, this is what aversion feels like. But the habit will be to just, I hate winter. I hate winter. I hate winter. And this is what you're up against. It's what we're all up against, is that these habits come up and then they just go down this pathway of whatever it might be. And the training of the mind is to not take those pathways. So the mind wants to think that way. Oh, gosh, I have to stand by the bus. No, I'm training the mind. What does this aversion feel like? And if you're with that, then the tendency towards aversion is not fed. And if the tendency toward aversion is not fed, it starves. You starve it. You basically starve it to death. So you're fasting on anger. And then in that cessation of aversion, the experience is much different, isn't it? Right? The heart is not infected with that. Not afflicted with that. So to actually then notice these things and to sit through them is a kind of very uncomfortable kind of feeling. To feel aversion and not blame yourself or anyone else is quite unpleasant. And the desire mind wants a pleasant kind of sense experience. It wants chocolate or whatever, television. It wants to move away from that. It wants to move away from the unpleasant. It wants to go towards the pleasant. And as long as there's a movement that way, the mind is in this endless restlessness, always seeking the next event, which is fulfilling or whatever. But in the stopping, and in the taking responsibility, and in the witnessing, one begins to have this different kind of confidence. You have the confidence of the trained mind. So you know that even though it might come up negative, it's all right. You can train with it. You can work with it. And one does get more and more that feeling, oh, this is a chance for purification. More and more there is that kind of confidence. Not as a smarmy kind of New Age thing, oh, good, another growth experience, right? But rather, you know, you really know. You know, this is a chance. This is a chance to work with your mind, to go beyond it. And that idea of purification is hard to get a hold of in the beginning. I know for me, when I started to really work with fear and anxiety, it was about my third year, I made this kind of determined effort to understand that. It just seemed hopeless. It's awash with this stuff. This seems so hopeless. And in the encouragement of the teaching, and a faith in the law of karma, and putting down thought, and all that, and that determination to work with it for many lifetimes, you know, that's what quite often can keep one going. Because sometimes these things keep repeating themselves. So, but it does have, if you understand the law of karma, goodness begets goodness. Right? Acceptance begets acceptance. Awareness begets awareness. This is a kind of amplifying effect. So the negative states of mind are the egotistical states of mind. They're the alienating states of mind. They're the separative states of mind. And when they fall away, one does begin to experience the divine qualities of the heart. One can encourage those. So say, Saturday, a couple of friends came from Toronto in the afternoon, and they had been to Byward Market. They'd been in a bakery, and they brought back some just delightful baked goods, which smelled great. Now, I've got some protocols where I don't eat in the afternoon, right? So, Mom was in her room, so when they went, hey, I said, hey, Mom, got some goodies. She said, oh, what is it? And so she came in the kitchen and gave her some of these lovely baked goods, and she was really happy. And she said, oh, give me some more. I said, oh, yeah. And the happiness I had for her was deeper than the happiness I had for the baked goods the next morning. It's a different kind of happiness, isn't it? It's the happiness of the heart not being selfish anymore. Not being so concerned with its bit of strudel that it feels jealous about your old lady there, mother. It's a different kind of happiness, isn't it? And that's the happiness of the mind, the luminous mind, because it's not blocked by ego, the selfishness of the ego, the self-obsession with the ego. We're always kind of worried about our own trip. And the people who offered that, the joy of their generosity, they just came and said, oh, would you like some of this? And that kind of generosity, that's a beautiful quality of the heart. And that is the kind of possibility the heart has, but that's not a programmed thing. And it's not something that you can force, can you? It's something that you can encourage. When one can look at other people's happiness, and the Buddha suggests that, to see the beauty and joy in other people, and to keep cultivating those positive states of mind. But they're there. They're the potential of the human heart when it is not self-obsessed. Right? But to get there, you cannot do it with willpower. You cannot will yourself to be loving. You can make suggestions, may all beings be well, may they be free from suffering. What's the guy making all the noise? Like on a retreat, people do metta practice, right? And they're getting really, and then they get angry at the salad bar because someone took the olives. And then you know, they've been doing this for 2 hours, this kind of love to everyone. It's true, isn't it? Everyone's been a retreat. We all know that. But that's okay, you know, because what happens is that suggestion comes up, and then the karma comes up. So you make the suggestions of goodness, but you cannot will yourself to the purification of heart. The way you come to the purification of heart is through patience. It's through acceptance. It's through self-responsibility, through taking that witnessing. Huh? And all of that is training. All of that's the work. It doesn't come easy. But it's very doable, you know, and it does give meaning to all this kind of stuff that we experience as human beings. So the Buddhist teaching is, again, it's this lovely kind of seeming paradox where we tend to talk a lot about suffering, and yet the Buddha was a pretty happy chap. Right? That's a good one. Peaceful. Right? And because if we don't understand the basic nature of conflict and we don't take responsibility for that, then we don't really see where the problem is. Now, what I found in my practice is it took me a while to kind of figure out the moods of mind that I suffered from. So like anxiety, fear was one kind of package, and aversion and annoyance, one kind of package, and then greed, another kind of package, and then loss. You know, sort of a few packages that one has. Not that many, actually. The storylines are endless, right? But actually, when you get deeper than thought, deeper than the storyline, it's typically just a few kinds of moods that one suffers from. So that was helpful, to go from the specific to the general, to go from the specific person that I feel annoyed at to the understanding of annoyance is a movement towards generality, right? And it's a deeper movement into the heart, a deeper movement into consciousness. If I'm just in the specifics, they might be true and I might have to deal with them, undoubtedly, but I'm not understanding the moods of the mind, and the moods of the mind are what condition the karma. So I come back to some kind of basic things like anger, and that's why you say, you know, getting rid of greed, hatred, and delusion, things like that. So that was that kind of inquiry and self-understanding is very, very helpful. And then from that, I found very, very useful is to simplify it even more and to see it in the body. To see how moods are reflected in the body. How moods are reflected in the breath. How moods are reflected in tension in the body, in the muscles, in the breathing. And this is where body awareness comes in. Mind, body are really undividable, they affect each other, don't they? And as the awareness gets more and more in touch with the reality of the way things are, then you have a very simple practice. You just see any form of egotism, any form of alienation closes you down in various ways. It might be in the shoulders, it might be in the breath channel, it might be in the head. You know, when you're thinking it, you're feeling it in your head, in the temples. And as one is more and more aware of the body, then one can just relax into that more and more. Just relax the breath. And so from a very complex consciousness of you know, ideas and thoughts and all of that, you come back to something very, very simple. And that's what the teaching is trying to do. It's a very complex teaching. You know, the texts are very, very dense. But actually, it's coming back to something very, very simple. Awareness of the way things are. And non-attachment. Now, attachment, non-attachment is very, very important language that we have in Buddhism. But if you have a way of seeing non-attachment in the body, just keep letting go. And it gets, you know, it's very, very simple. But you have to figure it out. You kind of have to figure it out for yourself. You can't. The books are fine. But you have to figure out who you are. You can't just dismiss yourself. You can't just repress it. You can't distract it. You have to take the time to understand yourself. Not through thought, right? Not through analysis, but through awareness. And then as that self-understanding comes, there's more and more confidence in the path, in the practice, in the letting go. And then there's a possibility of realizing the luminous heart. And then it gets plotted over, and then you start again. But you have a path, and that's very joyous, to have a path. Yes. Yes, that's where intuition functions. Insight is allowed to come through that. Because in the witness and consciousness, you're not tainted by the past. Like, I've read a lot of books about enlightenment. I shouldn't have read so many. Because now, you know, I'm always trying to get what I got, and, you know. And as long as my mind is like coming from a pre-programmed idea of what I should be getting, I'm not aware. Right? And it's this kind of witnessing and opening up in a fresh way, which is terribly difficult. And that's what we're just trying to encourage. And within that, then there's a possibility of the new arising, insight, intuition arising. But as long as I'm with the old, I'll only be perceiving through the old. I'll be judging through the old, and so on. So it's like this freshening of the mind. Awareness, you know, the different ways that I just keep changing the language around that, what that is, witnessing. Yeah. It's awareness, yeah. And when Christ says, what does Christ say? I am the life, the truth, and the way. Is that right? To me, that's awareness. I'm a Christian. That the only way that makes sense to me. So he's not pointing to himself, it seems. I shouldn't talk about other religions because I don't know them. But for me, that's how I interpret it. He's not talking about himself. He's pointing to what he is. I am that. So then I can find unity in all of it. In, you know, those great traditions. Yeah? What else? Anyone? Well, if I'm rattling on, you know, I'm just indulging in aversion. And thinking averse thoughts, then that's an uncontrolled mind in that sense. So it's around right thought and wrong thought. So if I make a suggestion, be careful, right? Then I won't be following that energy. So it's not controlling from desire, but there's certainly effort and energy in there to redirect the thought, to think in different ways. We don't like the word control quite often because it can imply repression, I suppose. That kind of way. So choose your language carefully, because sometimes the language doesn't go across the discipline. Yeah, so it's a lot of it is around thought. Any others? Don't know. Oh, Wendy.
Yes.
Back to the same question, but
seems to me is constant and keeps going, and then I'm convinced they'll survive the death of the body and so on. And I know in some experiences the witness disappears, the perspective disappears, but the thing is that the mystery and the difficulty is that in falling back on the witness, in a sense, to me, that would be what could create the idea of an I that is separate from that continuum.
So you identify that, say, I am the witness. But even that thought can be known.
Sorry?
But even that thought can be known. That's the interesting thing about it. When I say, I am the witness, who said that? So it's like Ajahn Sumedho, the way he teaches is you can't find the knowing, you can be the knowing. Or he would say more radically, be Buddha. And well, that's a bit much, but what Buddha means is awake. So when you try to think about it, then you're just in time and analysis and so on. So there has to be a tremendous faith in that. Giving up to that. And then see what happens within that. Because it's really undecipherable, I think.
It seems to be very persistent, and probably the one thing that is kind of stable, that doesn't change.
One reliable thing. So we would say mindfulness is the path to the deathless. Right? We wouldn't say that mindfulness is the deathless, Nibbana. We say mindfulness is the path. So the sustaining of, but if that's the statement, then it also has to be conjoined with deathless, with Nibbana, with the spiritual goal. It's not completely, but somehow it has to be a part of it. So if we have faith in that, and we let go of our attachment to seeking something else with craving and sense consciousness, it's that trusting and waiting which we can develop, but we can't figure it out. And that's what's very hard, is the trusting and waiting, because we want whatever it is, or we want to get rid of it.
But it's still one thing more than any other that creates a sense of self.
Well, allow that sense of self to be known and see what happens. Because certainly the attachment to the witnessing is one of the final stages that happens. Because one thing, I am the witness, is a kind of stage that they talk about. But in that, in the silence of that inquiry, even that is known to be what it is. But one has to be silent with that. One has to allow the program to open, as it were. And it's that allowing that's very difficult. Like last talk, I talked about grace, right? Which is a Christian word. And we've had these inter-monastic dialogues with Christian monastics, and that was one of the first questions they asked us, well, what's grace in Buddhism? Where does that come in? Well, that's a good question. Because I don't like to dismiss other traditions. I like to think, well, they've got a point there. What does it mean? And to me it seems to when does insight arise, or something new, getting back to that, is when one allows insight to arise, meanness to arise, and allows that to take place. And then there's vipassana. We call it vipassana insight. Which is, you can't figure it out intellectually. You can use intellect to kind of get you there. And then you have to let go of intellect. You have to let go of doubt. You know? At least that's the game I play. Well, in your tradition, in Advaita Vedanta, the masters say their conscious awareness functions through sleeping, waking, and dreaming. Now, I don't experience that. That depth isn't there. So I can't answer. But I think what's happening with delusion is that we are so deluded by time and self that we take that as the normal thing. And the spiritual life is that behind that there's the timeless, not a function of time. And that's what's so very hard to get to. That's why the religious experience is so rare, I suppose. And because we identify with the self and time. Well, identity. Are we getting too refined, or what? Anything else? Yes. Right, okay. That's one way. Yeah, why don't you be really competitive with her? That's what you often do with something which is negative and you don't like, as long as it's not immoral or harmful. Go for it. You just be mean and competitive. And then let go of it. So you're allowing this to come up into consciousness, because you know it's like this rotten thing in your mind which you'd rather not have there. And then there's less fear of it, because it has to be. You know, if something becomes conscious, we say consciousness is the escape hatch. So actually, if it comes up conscious and you don't, if you're not averse to it, you don't make it a problem, then the tendency towards that lessens. It's actually a good thing. So ideally, actually, this person is a wonderful person for you letting go of competitiveness. But the way you feel that is by feeling competitive. That's the irony of it. So this is your teacher for competitiveness. And if you find it so troublesome, then go for it. Trip her or something. But then get it out. Make it conscious. And say, oh, this is what it feels like. Right? It feels this way. So you again, you're studying this. You're not saying I'm a bad person, because it's not you. It's just the stream of consciousness has been conditioned that way. It's not you. It's just a function in nature, but it's a suffering function because it's an alienating function, right? But you have to study it. What is this like? And what is the body? And try to see it in your body, rather than as a judgment. You know, how does it? And then the feelings it has towards people. I make it a long-term study. So, it's my old friend, competitiveness. And then once you know it, it's like the example I give. I've given this one. There was in Stokes Valley, there was this white picket fence. Stokes Valley is the place I live and lived in New Zealand. And there's this white picket fence. First time I walked by this white picket fence, there was a dog behind it. And the dog, German Shepherd, right? You just wait for people. Because in a white picket fence on the side, you can't see through it. Some of you, when you get 9 degrees on, so I think, whoa, and you jump up, and I just jumped out of my skin. You know, I just kind of ran for it. So I didn't understand that actually it was safe. So the second time, I went by the white picket fence. I was a bit nervous. He jumped up, and I jumped, but I didn't run away. And then after a while, you know, just the dog. And then one day, it was really weird, someone wanted to take my picture. And I stopped by the white picket fence and just leaned against it. And they took my picture and the dog was looking up. But that's the way of the mental things. You know, you get surprised by them. You get overwhelmed by them. And where I've learned a lot is in repetition. You know, those situations which are just one-off disasters I don't learn from, I just survive them. But those situations where I've been like, a repeated pattern with a person or a situation, fear, anger, whatever, I've just had to go back into it. I've really learned a lot. So there, you know, if you keep putting that positive spin on it, it does lead to liberation. And then you can be, there's nothing wrong with being competitive. You know, it's fine. Don't cheat. So then, you know, then you can tell competitiveness feels this way, go for it. Or like one of the monks, he's a Kiwi monk, he's very competitive, he loves it. He has a great time beating people. But he's not neurotic about it, he's just the kind of gung-ho guy. And it's actually quite delightful. Because we're all so nice in the monastery. I was playing darts with him in Latvia. So you can get, like, in religious life, a bit too sort of holier than thou, and, you know. So you're kind of getting real about these things. But if it's alienating, you know, and the heart's not open, that's the song. That's the song, and the heart's not open.